when they brought the shotgun with the laser and with the flashlight and pointed in my face, and I was in front of the jail door, the cell door, and he kept on pointing, and I stood standing, and he didn't shoot. I said, "Oh, oh my God, they're not gonna kill us." So that kind of broke the effect.
How did you organize riots in prison, and what did they involve?
I didn't see the moment that Itamar Ben-Gvir came, but it came like in a moment that was 200, 300 activists put there, seated in very uncomfortable positions for hours. And then people stood up and said, you're a war criminal, you're a baby killer, you're not coming here, we're not going to be listening to your lies.
In prison is where they found their solidarity. It's where they would be with each other. They'd be in jail cells together. They'd strategize together.
And they were very aggressive in Ashdod Port. They were the ones throwing my head to the ground, throwing Geretta's head to the ground, asking her to hold an Israeli flag, and beating people up. And I would say to them directly to their face, because you're doing genocide and ethnic cleansing for 8 decades, because they're putting Gaza in a legal siege for 18 years.
I have, someone wants to say hi to you.
Khaled gives his final goodbyes to you.
Yes, bye, Khaled.
Final for today. Hopefully there'll be many
others. I hope I see you soon. No final goodbye.
Thiago, are you ready?
Yes.
Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today, I'm happy to speak to Thiago Avila. Thiago, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashwin. For me, it's a pleasure to be here.
For those of you who you probably know Thiago, if you are watching our show, he was a very prominent, one of the main prominent members of the flotilla, the Sumut flotilla, that went recently trying to break the siege of the siege that Israel has on Gaza. And before that, he's been part of a few other flotilla movements, which we'll get to find out about. Thiago, thank you so much for joining us. To be honest with you, we have about an hour, I think, before you need to go and help your wife with something. But I want to start off not by going through like the details of what happened to you during the flotilla. We'll go through that a bit later. But I first just want to start off by asking you, having come back now from a few visits on trying to break the siege, what's your takeaways? Like, give me like 3 or 4 takeaways on what you've learned about yourself and Israel and its genocide on Gaza and the people that you spend time with while trying to break the siege.
Ashfaq, I believe the main thing that comes after so many attempts to break the siege, which is actually a legacy from 17 years of attempt to break the siege of 18-year-long illegal siege over Gaza, is that we see that this helps to create part of the global uprising. So the global uprising that is happening in solidarity with Palestine has defeated Zionism and has defeated imperialism. But the problem is that imperialism and Zionism, they're very smart and they have the ability to give their rings, not to lose their fingers. So Trump, one of the war criminals, one of the complicits with genocide, try to show up as a peacemaker and then try to get the Nobel Prize and does all that and creates the condition of pressure in Israel for a limited ceasefire, but still maintaining a protectorate and maintaining colonial domination over Palestine. So this is something that was never a peace plan. It was a limited ceasefire, which we can see the effects right now. That right now, Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel Katz and the war cabinet, the war criminals cabinet, they are already bombing Gaza again. So it's important that we have the capacity to understand these moves, that they lost in public opinion, they lost in social mobilization, they lost in diplomacy, they're losing everywhere. But instead of admitting that they were doing something evil to a people that does not deserve to live through that, they try to create a new way of maintaining their privilege and their domination and their hegemony in the region. So that is something that is challenging as well. So we see in one way the global uprising that is more powerful than any oppressive regime, but in order to numb that, neutralize that, a new proposal of a limited ceasefire that is still maintain colonial domination, still maintain Israel dominating more than half of Gaza, and now with military bases in the outskirts, and so many violations, and of course with the possibility of what's happening right now, the breaking the ceasefire, claiming any false claims about the corpses and the bodies of the hostages and everything. So to give an excuse to continue attacking the Palestinian people. So in 8 decades of genocide and ethnic cleansing, which structured itself into an apartheid colonial state, and which is led not by a religion, but by a racist and supremacist ideology called Zionism. And that needs to be defeated, like other generations defeated apartheid in South Africa, like other generations defeated Nazism and fascism. It's our turn to defeat Zionism and U.S. imperialism once and for all. We know it's possible. We just need to work very hard.
Tiago, I think this was your second flotilla that you were on, right? And you have been detained both times by Israel for a few days. The first time you were in solitary confinement for a while. This time, you know, there was a lot of abuse. What did you learn? I mean, obviously, like you've said, we know that Israel, you know, is a brutal state. They've been brutalizing Palestinians for 8 decades, as you mentioned. But when you personally experience some of that, you know, very little brutality compared to what everyone else has experienced, what did you actually just learn, like personally, about Israel? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, being in a prison of the Zionist regime is very pedagogical, because you see the racism and supremacism right there, like for everybody to see. We know that they really do a lot of mistreatment to international solidarity activists as well, but it's nothing, compared to what they do to Palestinians. The same prisons that we were, both in Givon, both in Ayalon, where I was sent the first time, and now Kitziot prison, the same prisons that we were, and they were instructed not to kill us, not to torture us for permanent damage, is the same prison that they do all these things to Palestinians. So they show the pictures. So we know that they are not only they are horrific in their ways of dehumanizing people when doing the most horrible violations, but also that they are weak and they are cowards, because they wanted to do the same thing with us. We could see in their eyes of the prison manager, for example, the captain of the tactical squad that will come into our every night with the shotgun and the laser pointing in our faces. But they didn't have the courage to do. They had the desire to do, but they didn't have the courage to do. So it's very sad to see that we are dealing with such a weak state, such a coward state, at the same time, such a state without any principles of value of human life, any sense of humanity, that it never ceases to amaze me that we are in a place where they think they have all the power, but they are actually very weak and they are actually very scared, because they are in a prison, in a colonial prison, and they come with all their faces covered and they just put their eyes, because they know that eventually they will be in The Hague. They will be made accountable for that. So they want to do this to scare us, but what we see are cowardly people. That actually, it's very sad to see what I was seeing. And in the end, Ashfaq, we know that there are blue-collar workers in every prison system in the world, and it's not about them. It's about the ones that make the decision. So Itamar Ben-Gvir will come into our prison and we'll try to make fun, we'll try to make videos accusing people, calling them terrorists. And what our team will say, all of our participants will say, that you are the war criminal. You're the one assassinating babies.
Can you take us a bit into that? I mean, did Ben-Gvir come into the prison that you were at on both occasions, or was it just this last time? Just tell us a bit about what you remember about that, what was said. Just take us into that world for those of us who weren't there.
Yes. Imagine one thing, Ashfaq. We are going on a solidarity mission to break the siege, to open a humanitarian corridor, to deliver food. Of course, our boats are small, so it's a limited amount of food and aid, but we're delivering it anyway. All of a sudden, we are boarded, kidnapped, taken instead of Gaza to Ashdod Port. In Ashdod Port, we received the first visit of the Ministry of Interior, Itamar Ben-Gvir.
This is the Sumud flotilla, right? Not the Madlin,
yeah,
that you were on earlier. Okay.
On the Madlin mission, we just heard that it was his orders that we never get any contact with the outside world.
Okay.
That we get a lot of restrictions that even other prisoners have in their prisons. But on the first mission that we got intercepted and arrested, we had no contact with him, just through social media and those.
Okay.
On the Global Smooth Flotilla, it was totally different, because he was planning to do this agitation video. So he wanted that. He brought his most aggressive team of his crew of policemen, and they were very aggressive in Ashdod Port. They were the ones throwing my head to the ground, throwing Geretta's head to the ground, asking her to hold an Israeli flag, and beating people up, and so was.
So this happened in the prison where your head was put to the ground and Greta's head to the ground, or was it at the actual port, like with all the other activists around?
At the very moment we arrived at port, I didn't.
So you arrived like at night in the morning.
Yes, because there were 42 boats trying to get to break the siege, Ashraf. So they came in many different hours. But our boat, where me and Greta we were, it was the Alma boat, was the lead boat. So it took us 16 hours to get to port. So it was already dark. So when we got to Ashdod port, most of the boats were already there. And when they took us, first they took Greta and did these violations with her. And then they started taking people by groups. And eventually they took me. But they also separated me from the rest as one of the organizers of the mission. And then I didn't see the moment that Itamar Ben-Gvir came, but it came like in a moment that was 200, 300 activists put there, seated in very uncomfortable positions for hours waiting for him. And when he came, he was trying to make his video to agitate, like calling them terrorists and everything. And then people stood up and said, you're a war criminal, you're a baby killer, you're not coming here, we're not going to be listening to your lies. And so they would take these people away and beat them up and do very violent reactions on them. But eventually,
so as to understand the picture probably, so as the activists used to sort of would be calling out Ben-Gvir, then you know the police or the security would come and isolate them and take them away. And yourself, you said you and Greta were taken and your heads were put against the ground.
You were
already taken away before Ben-Gvir came.
Yes, we didn't get the chance to see him come in then. But then after that, he found Greta and was there trying to provoke her and everything. So it was a lot of violations, actually. We could see not only that, after that, he went to prison in the desert. He took a four-hour drive from Tel Aviv to Kizeot in the Negev desert to go there and try to make the same videos again. And the same thing with the defense minister, Israel Katz, as well. They came there to try to make fun, to try to scare, to do psychological warfare. And what people said is that you will be in The Hague. You should really be afraid because you are starving children to death. The whole world knows how racist, how evil of a person you are. So they tried to do his little show, but it backlashed in the end. Didn't have any effect on our team. And it didn't have the effect that he wanted in social media as well. He looked weak anyway. Looked like a very futile person, like trying to go there and scream at people who are being violently arrested and maintained there in a foreign country, kidnapped in a humanitarian mission. So it had a serious backlash for them. In the end, the countries were pressuring so hard that it was part of countries creating sanctions, countries that expelled the entire diplomatic envoys of Israel in their countries like Colombia. So we've seen a lot of backlash of their violations in prison. So that's why we always say like this, actually. This is nothing compared to what they do to Palestinians. There are 11,000 Palestinians, 400 of them are children in the Israeli dungeons, and we need to speak up for them. But there were violations anyway, and we need to tell them, because if they do that to international activists that are so visible in media, imagine what they don't do to Palestinians every day. So it's pedagogical that we mention that as well, but not centered
in ourselves.
The center is Gaza.
No, absolutely. So I just want to recap your sort of your journey, just to give us an idea. I mean, many people may have read about this, but there's people seeing this who have no idea. So your boat was intercepted, the Alma boat. It was one of the first two, yours and the family boat. So, and then you spend 16 hours at sea, basically captured. So I'm guessing in front of Israeli commandos while they were gathering the other 42 boats. And then they brought all of you, I mean, in drips and drabs to the Ashdod port. You and Greta and other people were separated. And then Ben-Gvir comes there, and then all of you, or I guess maybe you were transported separately, but all of you were transported 4 hours into the prison, right? And then Ben-Gvir, you know, followed and came and said hi again to you. So were you separated for this entire period? Were you in like a separate jail cell? Were you with other people? What is it like for you? What was your was it 5 days, 4 days in captivity? What is it like for you compared to the rest of the group? And what do you remember from that?
Yeah, we stayed 7 days. Most of the people stayed 7 days in Kizeot prison. There were two turns of people that went earlier than that. Well, a group with 3 days, a group with 5 days, and the other group, most of the people with 7 days. And I was not isolated from people most of the time. They took me to over 10 different cells. So they would change me from cell every time. They would take me to long interrogations for the entire day, one interrogation after the other. They would threaten me a lot because they wanted information about the mission. And what I would say to them is, look, all of what we do in our steering committee is public information. We have nothing to hide. We have nothing to hide on why do we do it, how do we do it, how do we mobilize people, and that the fact that we will continue mobilizing. And until this siege stops and ceases to exist, we will have flotilla missions to break it. And they were very angry. They were trying to understand why would we do it. And I would say to them directly to their face, because you're doing genocide and ethnic cleansing for 8 decades, because they're putting Gaza in a legal siege for 18 years. We are not afraid of you. So I would tell them things, and they would ask, so who is your steering committee? I said, look in our website, public. we're not afraid of telling.
And this continued. They did this for the whole period that you were there every day. Like, or was this like 2 hours of the day, or was it 16 hours of the day? Just no. Give us a sense. I mean, you know, what was it like? And like, was it the same interrogators interrogating you all the time? Would they change? Just, you know, take us from what you can remember. Take us to back to what that was like.
Yes, when we got to prison, they separated from genders. So women would go to two different pavilions, and men would go to two different pavilions. Pavilions of this Kidzio prison that had Palestinians before, but they emptied these pavilions to stay just with the flotilla mission. And when I was put there, I was put in a cell with everyone else. But the problem is that the cell that I was put into, the cell lost all their rights. The right to go to take a sun, to see the sun, the right to take showers, because they never allowed me any time to go outside or to take a shower or anything. Me, as 200 other people, we were on a hunger strike the moment we got into prison. To denounce the violations that were happening, to pressure for the immediate release, but also to say that they are offering us food because we have visibility, because they are denying the same food in Gaza. So it was part of our political statement in prison. But eventually, they were being so violent that they were denying the medication for people for severe diseases. For example, diabetic patients with 3 days without insulin. And then I started a third strike as well to mobilize for that. And not only me, but other people as well. And we also started rioting in prison. So we were making a lot of noise.
How did you organize riots in prison, and what did they involve?
When I was going from one interrogation to the other, they would always move me to different cell. I never stayed in the same cell. So whenever they took me out, they will never bring me back to the same cell. In a way for me not to get feeling safe. So what was happening is that I was actually not bothered by that. I was actually liking it because I could check on people, how they were, how were they coping with it, how were they dealing with it. So in the end, we started to create a whole communication way, and we were screaming through the hallways and everything. So
to be clear, so this is just because the women are in another sort of wing and it's just the men, or could you communicate with women and men when you guys are kind of organizing these riots?
We could hear each other when we were very, very loud. So we could not have a conversation, but when we were like screaming, for example, we were screaming, insulin for cell 16, we were saying, insulin for 16, like 100 people screaming the same thing and banging on the doors and the windows, everything. They could hear us, but they could not really understand. They just heard a lot of noise. And of course, when they heard Free Palestine, they could recognize because they're more used to that chant. But
I mean, when they heard those kind of things, obviously they'd get aggravated. But like, would it be a case of when hearing those things, they would then come and find a few people and, you know, beat them up or rough them up a little bit? Because obviously, like you're saying, they kind of like they're hurting you in a controlled way because they need to kind of manage their public relations. Or was the abuse that you faced, was it more calculated, or would it be emotive? Would they react to kind of, you know, you saying these things which clearly upset them? Or was the hurting of you and the abuse that you got and other people got, was it more calculated?
The thing is, Ashfaq, that they were already doing violations all of the time with us. They would come hour to hour, banging on the doors, ordering everybody to stand up, to count people and put them back to sleep, and turn on the lights to deprive people from sleeping. And then they would come with the tactical team with shotguns and lasers and flashlights pointing at people's faces and dogs.
And this was daily, all the time?
Daily, every day. So when we did these things, it didn't change anything. The procedure was the same. So eventually they would try to harass me more. For example, they would, the first 3 days, they took me pretty much all day into different interrogations, like you were asking. They would take me to interrogation with people who identified as intelligence service. He didn't say it was Mossad, Shin Bet, or any other. And then they took people who said they were from the foreign office of the IOF, of the Israel Defense Forces, that they call. And then they would take me to the prison manager, and then they would take me to people who never identified themselves. And they were asking the same thing, asking about my family, asking about our solidarity movement, asking about why we do that. And they were trying to do those stupid tactics, like the good cop and bad cop. And they would say, Thiago, you don't look like a terrorist leader. Look how... What is the racist thing that you don't see in me that you were expecting to see? So it's so annoying, actually, to see that when they create so many stereotypes on people, and they were saying, because you're not screaming Allah Akbar. And I said, do you know what Allah Akbar means? And he said, yes, it's a religious chant. I said, so do you have a problem with that? If someone was saying, praise be God, would you have a problem with that? He said, no. And I said, that's what they were saying. When they say Allah Akbar, God is almighty, all powerful. You say that in your church or in your synagogue, anywhere. So they were also saying, but they keep saying Takbir Allah Akbar. And I said, it's still religious chant. So the fact that you don't understand does not make this threatening. You need to understand people's culture. You need to stop dehumanizing them. So it was very annoying. And they were asking the political reasons, and I would say very, very clearly to them. So I didn't refrain from saying a single word to them, just because they were there, they were being threatening. But I wanted to show them an example that we should not fear them. The same thing that I said to the judge as well. So what I was saying is that you cannot stop us through violence. You need to understand that the way to stop this is the way that South Africa stop this type of violence, by ending the root cause. And the root cause is racial segregation. This is apartheid regime. And I was saying to them, don't you want a future where your kids, nobody will ask what are their religion, what are their ethnic group, that they will have the same rights as everybody else and you're not feeling insecurity? And they will say, yes, I do want that. But the problem is that the others don't want that. And I said, but you're the ones with the bombs. You're the ones with the guns.
When you mean by the others, you mean do they mean the other Israelis or do they mean the Palestinians?
No, they mean the Palestinians. They yeah, always kept repeating Golda Meir saying, if we put down our weapons, we'll cease to exist.
We'll get thrown into the sea, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, you mentioned a few things, like you mentioned South Africa, and I want to draw from that, but I'll come later to that. Obviously, it was a big gathering. It was like 500 activists in total, many different countries. There were many, many active. You are from Brazil. There were many from the Global South, many from Africa, many who don't have white skins, right? Did you notice the difference? And I've heard many reports that there is a difference, and we've been hearing about this for a long time, between how the Israelis would treat white-skinned people versus darker-skinned people. And I mean, were you locked up in a mixed bag? Were you segregated when locked up? When you were locked up, you know, how many people were in a room with you? Did you have kind of special privileges as a senior member, in the sense that because they were interrogating you in your holding cell, there was less people, or was it the same as everyone else? Just what do you recollect from all of that?
Yes. First of all, about structural racism there, it's everywhere. So we would see a huge difference when they were dealing with an Italian cell and they were dealing with a cell of the Tunisians, for example.
Okay, so they lock people up as Italians and Tunisians and South Africans. And...
Not that much, but
okay.
There were three
sometimes.
Cells in the beginning, and the first three cells of the pavilion was concentrated with Tunisians, Libyans, and Turkish. So we don't know which method, because they were not a single nationality, but they were mostly concentrated there. And there, at the end of the hall, there was a few cells with mostly Italians as well. So, but they were not only nationality. For example, I was put in these cells eventually. In all of these cells.
So you were with the Italians.
No, they would change me from cell to cell. So I was with the Italians, and I was always treated bad. And the cell that I was, they got penalty that didn't get to take shower, didn't get to go outside.
But and I mean, for just three cells, I'm guessing there's a lot of people in these cells. Is it like 70, 80 people in the cell?
No, the cell is prepared for 10 people, but they eventually would put 16, 17 people.
Okay.
So,
and how big is this 10 people cell? Like just like
it's
meters?
It's like a three per three.
Three by three. So in nine square meters was 17 of you. And you were there for like, you know, between 4 and 7 days.
Yes, that's it. It was started to get less crowded, they would merge cells again. So it continued to get crowded. When they start to empty the cells in the back and concentrating people in the cells up front.
So you mean at some point there were like 30 people in a 3 by 3 meter cell?
No, it didn't get to 30, but maybe 20. But people would have to put the small mattress in the ground. And eventually they would come with the tactical team and push people from one cell to the other and change people in order to confuse and do psychological warfare. And they would not even let the person take the mattress. So the person would have to stay for a few hours without a mattress until he got a chance to try to get a mattress. So
people are you just sitting? Are you just standing? You obviously can't lie down and sleep. There's not enough place. Or do you sleep in shifts? Like what would you do?
No, there was a way to feed everybody. Was not.
Like I guess just lying right next to each other.
Yes, it was enough for everybody to be lying down, but it was not comfortable or anything.
Yes, of course, obviously.
Yeah, but I have to be very honest with you, Ashfaq. The conditions on Kidzio prison, the structure is not the most horrific part of it. It's the treatment that they do to Palestinians. There is a torture camp when we were not there. On the other hand, Ayalon prison, where I was in solitary confinement the previous mission, was a medieval prison with rats, without seeing the daylight and anything else. Much, much worse in structure, but the treatment in Kidzio, what they do to Palestinians from Gaza, is way worse.
Okay, so I mean, and what would you be eating? I mean, I'll come to your previous experience as well, when you were in solitary confinement. But for this period where you were with the members of the Sumud Flotilla, what were you? What meals were you eating once a day? Were you eating multiple times a day? What would they give you? Would it change? Was it much worse? And then you'd get like rewarded with, you know, that's an awful word to use, but would there be meals that are slightly better? Just what was that like?
Yeah, we were with 462 participants that were intercepted that night, and half of these people were on hunger strike. I was one of the people on hunger strike, so I never ate anything, but they offered food. So the food had
rice. The entire period that you were there, you ate nothing?
Yes, for 7 days. Not only me, but over 200 people.
So, and, I mean, did you drink water?
Yes, I... On the previous
so you had a water fast, but you basically had no food at all. No, you didn't. Whatever they gave you, you refused to eat.
Yes, and they offered food. We cannot say that about them, but most.
I mean, they would offer food because you're on a hunger strike.
Yes. Actually,
so it's part of like a psychological, you know.
Yes, the same. When they, for example, they had no bottled water for anyone. But the 2 days that I was on a thirst strike to claim for medication for the people that they were refusing, when they brought me to interrogation, there was a whole lot of sweet
nice water
and bottled water. And I said, oh my God, this is so lame for them to do it. Like so vulgar to see the way.
Yeah, I mean, but it's absolutely something that they would do.
Yes. Nobody fell for that. So they were doing.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask a few more. I mean, sorry if these sound pedantic questions, but I mean, for us who weren't there, this is actually very valuable information. So, I mean, half of the people are plus minus having a hunger strike and the others are not. So would you guys be mixed? Did they separate those who are having a hunger strike from those who are not? You know, and those who were like not, who were eating, what would they be eating?
Yes, people were mixed. In a cell, have like more than half of the people on a hunger strike, the less than half not on a hunger strike.
Yes.
And we'll have the people that were eating, they were receiving like rice, eventually some tomatoes, some potatoes, basic food. Eventually there was a day that was lentils as well. So nobody who was eating was feeling hungry. Because actually there was all the food of the
okay,
people
so they
that
gave
were
you, and it, I mean, these were like, and the food wasn't like infested with worms or anything of that sort.
No, it was not. The thing is that people didn't feel good by eating that food, even there was the
yeah, of course, because
yeah, Because it's a violation anyway. They're denying the same food to the Palestinians in Gaza.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. You're eating it because you kind of have to. And also, half of their fellow comrades and activists are not eating. And so I see that. I can see why. I mean, you're right. The Israelis weren't incentivized to kind of use food as a weapon of torture because of the fact that you are all kind of fasting anyway. I mean, not fasting, going on a strike. What I wanted to discuss is that, you see, it sounds to me, this sounds like a very difficult experience, obviously, but as you mentioned, it's nothing compared to the Palestinians. But in a way, it also creates solidarity among the activists because you are all there together. You know, possibly, you know, in Barcelona, not the people who still left from Barcelona, once you get on the boats, you have an opportunity to reconvene in Tunisia again. But once you're all on boats in Tunisia, you're all separate, right? And so when you're in prison, kind of like you're meeting many, many activists that you haven't met before. And it's kind of a moment of solidarity. And what it sounds to me like, I'm South African. And in the 50s and 60s, and in fact, throughout South Africa's period of you know, struggling against apartheid, this is, I mean, not always, because often they would torture people to death in many prisons. People were killed, they were thrown from balconies, and obviously there were also political assassinations. But by and large, a lot of the activists, you know, from the most senior activists, Nelson Mandela, etc., to young activists, would actually, in prison is where they found their solidarity. It's where they would be with each other, they'd be in jail cells together, they'd strategize together. In fact, during the Rivonia trial, you know, most of the senior members of the ANC, about 30 of them, managed to be in a cell and they were able to strategize their entire legal defense, etc. And it's a wonderful experience. And I can see, you know, that you are thinking about it with nostalgia as I mentioned this. But what I've seen through my own study of the conflict and looking at the conflict is that it's almost like the Israelis learned about this from the South Africans. And as a result, what they do to Palestinians in Palestinian prisons is the exact opposite. They know that prison is a place where you can build solidarity. And so with Palestinians, they've broken them, they've separated them, they put them in solitary confinement, they've tortured them, they've killed them. You know, and it's just it's part of that psychological torture and also their ability to sort of diffuse solidarity and you know, diffuse an ability to have a rising up or sort of a political leadership that comes through and has cohesion that can kind of, you know, be effective. What's your you know, having been in an Israeli prison and having experienced this solidarity and having seen how Israel has, you know, diffused Palestinian leadership, what's your retort to that?
Yes, Ashraf. For me, it's something, first of all, there is the amazing part to see that they try to break people in many, many ways. So there's all type of psychological violence and psychological warfare that they do against people once they get into the prison system there. But when we are together as a community, like you said, solidarity flourish even in the worst environments. So we would see people that eventually they could be so broken and they were feeling so bad because of the hunger strike, but they would put all of their strength to bang on the doors, on the metal doors, to make noise, to ask, to demand for insulin for the diabetic patients, or to demand the cardiac patient to have his medication, or to demand a free Palestine, because every single day we would scream free Palestine. So they thought they would break us, and they come with the tactical team, and it did a lot of violence. But 5 minutes after they left, we were screaming once again free Palestine, so they could not really control us. Because once we understood they didn't have the order to kill us or to do permanent damage to us, none of the psychological warfare would matter to us, because we knew, we understood that at the first night, when they brought the shotgun with the laser and with the flashlight and pointed in my face, and I was in front of the jail door, the cell door, and he kept on pointing, and I stood standing, and he didn't shoot. I said, oh my God, they're not gonna kill us. So that kind of broke the effect. I had my hands on the iron, and I had my face. So they could have done so much damage to me if they wanted. They could have crushed my fingers. They could have done so many things. The moment they didn't do any of that, I said, okay, so they have the orders not to do anything while we are in their custody. And we can use it in our advantage, not to let anybody be broken by them, to show them as well, to say truth to power. And to but not only that, we were trying also to combine two different things. First is not to be afraid and to show them that we have our dignity, that we demand respect, and that we are not afraid of them because we are doing that for the right reasons. But the second thing is that we didn't disrespect anybody individually. We tried to separate what was the blue collar prison agent there. That was the one who was working in the worst place, far away in the desert, that nobody wanted to work, in very bad conditions themselves. So most of them were Arabics. Most of them were not white, for example. And we tried to separate that. And we tried to show that to them, that you should not dehumanize people of the same class as yours. Because the ones that are on top of the social pyramid, they don't care about us, but they don't care about you as well. That's what we would say to the prison guards. So we had these two different things. And what also I said on my last day there, I insisted on them so many times. And I said, I hope now you learn to respect people as humans. And when we are out of here, and when Palestinians are back here, please remember that the whole world is with that people, because somehow your leaders are trying to take away their humanity. So please treat them as humans. So that was something that we saw very clearly, that not all prison guards were on board with Netanyahu, with Itamar Ben-Gvir. They just wanted to make a living, and they didn't like being called bad names or being stereotyped out in the outside world, being treated like baby killers. They said themselves, I will never hurt a children. So they're working class, blue collar workers. They're part of a colonial system, of a colonial education that makes them reproduce so much violations, but it could be different, Ashwin. So that's something amazing to think, that even in the worst conditions, the worst horrific racist supremacist regimes, we can still see class conscience. We can still see that people can be saved somehow if we get rid of the structures of the apartheid colonial system. But that demands a lot of work. So what we saw about the situation in prison is that it was very hard to make sure that we have our basic needs attended. It took us a lot of effort in the rebellions that we did, in the hunger strike, in the thirst strike, in very courageous interventions where we were talking directly to them. But the Palestinians didn't have this benefit. They come to the same prisons, being tortured to death, being raped, being violated in so many worse ways. So they don't even have this. They don't have the option to go on a thirst strike because they don't receive any water for days. So they have no option of a hunger strike because they receive no food. So it was very frustrating to feel that we were in a condition that we were being treated much better than Palestinians, and still it was tough. I have to confess to you, it was not easy to be there these days.
Yeah, no, I mean, when you told me earlier on about how, you know, you sort of were holding the bars and the there was a prison warden or security guard kind of pointing a gun at you, and you realized when he can't hurt you, it emboldened you, and then you started screaming at them. And you know, and obviously the Palestinians don't have that luxury, and it's a very different experience, you know, in so many different ways. I mean, and we see it the same. I mean, most people have been protesting, not just, you know, to end the occupation of Palestinians, but I mean, people have been protesting for any reason in the last, you know, for however long they've lived, against the Iraq war, or, you know, local sort of protests against. And we often, most protesters have the standoff with the police, right? And the police are a meter away, and they're in their gear. And you know that there's times when they're going to kind of create a riot, but most of the time they're going to stand there just to kind of get in your way. And yes, protesters, you know, they start taunting the police, and they even start preaching to them and telling them, you know, your government's bad, or you should care, etc. And it's a very different experience for Palestinians, because, you know, even when they meet settlers, when they don't meet settlers, when they're chased down by settlers, there's where those that are violating you have a license to shoot, to hurt, to beat. You know, they've been breaking hands since the Intifada back in 1987. There was a policy, you know, by Rabin himself, who, you know, is seen as sort of like a peace mogul in some parts of the world. And it is a very, very, you know, jarring experience. I just want your, you know, your final sort of thoughts on that. And then I want you to tell me how you kind of managed, you know, what was the process to kind of for them to deport you and others back to, were you deported back to Brazil or where were you deported to?
Yes, whenever they deport people from a flotilla mission, because they said many things this time. The first mission we were treated as illegal immigrants on the judicial system of theirs. Now the second time when we were coming, they were saying that we would be framed as terrorists. Itamar Ben-Gvir was saying that himself.
Yes.
But they didn't. They still framed us as illegal immigrants. So when we got to Ashdod Port, they, under a lot of pressure and psychological violence, they said they were trying to pressure people to sign a document that would be confessing that we tried to enter Israel illegally, that we got caught, and that's why we were being deported, and that's why we were acknowledging that we would be banned for 100 years to go back to Israel. And we had already instructed, I trained people myself about nonviolence, and we also do the legal training with the participants saying, don't ever confess to a crime you didn't commit. So people refuse to sign this document. After people refuse to sign this document, they are still pressured. So the person says, but don't you want to go home? And then people have to say, but I'm not going to admit to a crime I didn't commit. But the way they ask, they're like, you want to go home? Because if you want to go home, just sign here. But people would be admitting to a crime. So then people would be taken to another place where on previous missions it was a different building, but now they put this whole structure into the port, which was a immigration office facility. So we'll talk to an immigration officer, and there was the first time that we'd see our lawyers. So the lawyers we have is from a collective of Palestinians from 48. So the Israelis, they call them Israeli Arabs to deny their identity as Palestinians. So Palestinians who were in the territories occupied during the Nakba. So they have Israeli citizenship, but they don't have the right to say everything they need to say about this colonial regime and to say all these violations. They lose their bar to be lawyers. They can go to jail. So there's a lot of violations against them as well. They say they are an equal state with equal rights. It's not true at all. So the lawyers, they stay with the immigration officer so that the immigration officer cannot pressure people to sign the documents as well. So to make sure that we have a clean hearing from the immigration officer. And the immigration officer says the same thing. So you try to enter, why did you try to enter Israel illegally? And then people will say, no, we were part of a humanitarian, nonviolent solidarity mission trying to get to Gaza. You intercepted our boat illegally in international waters. You changed our course from Gaza, which is Palestinian territory and Palestinian territorial waters, to Ashdod Port. And then you brought us here, so we never tried to enter Israel legally. And so he said, so you, my decision is that you're being deported. Would you want to sign a voluntary deportation document here so that you go from here to the airport? Or you want to go to jail, wait until a court hearing with a judge, and the judge can confirm the same decision that I did, or the judge can withdraw my decision to deport you? What is your choice? And for the previous missions, the people who would sign would go from there to the airport. This time, the people who signed, the people who didn't sign, they were taken to prison anyway because of the pressure of Itamar Ben-Gvir, who wanted to do a tougher treatment of people in prison this time. So we instructed people, Ashfaq, that we know that nobody wanted to sign because nobody wanted to cooperate in a situation that we're being kidnapped. It's a war crime, a violation of so many international laws, the ICJ provisional rulings that prohibit Israel to stop any humanitarian mission. So many violations in this interception. So nobody wanted to sign anything. But we always instruct people. So we say, look, people who are from countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel, it will be much harder to set you free. People who have tough health conditions because they refuse the medicine for people. So we advise people in more vulnerable situations to sign and to go home and to continue the struggle from home, so that the people that do not want to sign but they're not in such a vulnerable condition that need prescribed medication every single day, they can stay for longer. They have more conditions to continue the fight. So we instruct people, our legal team instruct the people more vulnerable to sign. But this time it didn't matter. So around 30% of our participants, of the 462 people, signed the document because they wanted to go first. It's part of our strategy as well. They go first, they tell the story, they continue breaking their lies and breaking their narrative by showing the truth of what happened. But this time they didn't allow. So everybody was sent to the desert, and like what we were expecting happened. They refused medication. They put people, the people from the Global South, people who didn't have diplomatic relations, like the Tunisians, were severely beaten on at port, but also when they were arriving into prison. So they try to intensify the violations, but that's the process that happens. They try first to make you sign that you enter illegally. You don't sign, then they made an immigration decision that you're deported. If you still challenge that, you go to prison for a court hearing. The judge, of course, all for 17 years, 100% of the cases, the judge said, you are deported, and you'll be deported immediately or as soon as we have a flight for you. So there was never a case that a judge said, oh, this deportation and this interception was illegal. They always comply with their war criminals, their bosses as well, in the illegal act of stopping humanitarian flotillas.
Okay. So, Tiago, we don't have a lot more time left. We have about sort of 10 or 12 minutes left. But I want to understand from you two things in this time, if we have the time. You've said that right in the start of this interview that, you know, we need to continue, you need to continue the movement of this flotilla movement and other protest movements need to continue. It's clear that you have intentions of doing this again. And tell us about the Global Flotilla Movement. It's obviously gained a lot of traction. It's been around, like you mentioned, for 17 years. In the last 2 years, because of the genocide that's happening in Gaza, there's been a lot of momentum. Just tell us what your current plans are, what this movement's plans is, and sort of how are you organizing and what do you plan on doing?
Yes, Ashfaq, we are part of a legacy that has been trying to break this illegal siege of 18 years for 17 years. So the siege starts in 2007. 2008, the first mission starts. The first five missions, they got to Gaza. Two small boats, they managed to get to Gaza. And imagine that. The first five boats that got to Gaza, when they got there, they were the first boats to dock in Gaza, the international boats, since the Six-Day War, since 1967. So the Palestinian people were so thrilled when they saw that flotilla mission getting there. It was such a celebration, such a ceremony, that they had the testimonials that we see from these moments, from the books and from the documentaries, that they felt that they were not alone anymore. So it was beautiful to read and to see that. So the people continue to do that. But after the first five missions, Israel started intercepting all of the missions and attacking some of them and killing 10 people in 2010 and bombing boats like they did last year with our boat in Malta, the Conscience, and throwing incendiary devices like they did to us in Tunis, and attacking with drones 14 boats in the same night like they did to us when we were close to Greece this time. So they've been attacking, intercepting, and doing bureaucratic warfare to stop our missions right at port. But throughout the years, 37 boats tried to make this journey, but on the Global Sumut Flotilla, only on that mission we have more boats than all the other boats combined that ever tried to make this journey. So it was a huge mission. Because we knew that, it's, like you said, the sense of urgency of the escalation of the genocide in the last 2 years demanded us to do that. When we were sailing, we were seeing the start of the full military invasion of Gaza City, which was the last stage of the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So the sense of urgency needed to be the maximum. So we're going not at the time that we wanted, because we wanted. Actually, it was the end of the sailing season. It was already quite dangerous because of the storms, and we actually got a storm in the middle of our way. So, but we will not wait until April next year to go. We needed to go at that moment because it was the moment that was necessary. And now we are preparing to go as soon as we can again with a bigger mission than before, because the conditions, the illegal siege of Gaza, the genocide and ethnic cleansing, the apartheid colonial system still exists. So we need to continue going. Even in the situation that the ceasefire, the fragile ceasefire holds, there's still not enough aid getting to Gaza. And the aid that gets into Gaza is still passing through the control of the occupying force, which is illegal by all international law concerning the Palestinian territories, whether it's Gaza, whether it's the West Bank, even if we only consider that they have 22% of historical Palestine, which is the 67 landmark and land division, which is completely, absolutely unfair to the Palestinian people, they still will need sovereignty over their area, self-determination over their area, control of their borders, control of their territorial waters. So we will never allow a mission, humanitarian mission of ours, to be controlled by the occupying force, because the occupation is illegal. So we will never abide to them, comply to them when they say, you cannot enter here. They're not the authority there. So we need to continue mobilizing. We've seen that the flotillas, they have the capacity, not only to concretely try to break the siege, and you almost did it, and next time we have a bigger mission, I'm sure we will do it. But we also have the capacity to be something that answer to the Palestinian people calling for international solidarity and mobilize in the streets this global uprising so that people would do huge demonstrations. Imagine that just in Rome, we had 1 million people, 4 million total in Italy in a general strike. And we had like hundreds of cities going to demonstrations simultaneously the day we got intercepted. So this has a power for the Palestinian cause. And that's why we need to continue doing that. We have a responsibility to continue doing that, because Palestine is not free yet, and it's a long walk to freedom. So we need to be there in solidarity. We make no difference, Ashraf, between my family and Palestinian families, and the family of all of our participants. We all have families. We all love our children, our fathers, our mothers, and we cannot even imagine to see our family members being starved to death, or crushed by bombs, or trapped into the rubble until they die of starvation as well. We cannot understand that. We'll never normalize something like that. So we need to continue mobilizing, because Gaza was not at peace before October 2023. 97% of the water was already contaminated. 60% of the people already depended on humanitarian aid to get every single meal in Gaza. They still, back then, they already controlled the calories that entered Gaza. They will still refuse chocolate to enter Gaza. They will refuse cement. They will refuse wedding dresses. They will refuse the most basic things for life, and even things that have no impact whatsoever, just to show their force and their strength to colonize and occupy the land. So we need to continue mobilizing, because this condition is unbearable for humanity. So that's why we keep on going. We have a way of organizing that we were 44 different national delegations. For the next mission, we want all the people from all the world combined. We want every single country in the world. We want to have our People's United Nations on that mission. We want to have a representative of each and every country of the world. And we want not only to have people on boats, but want to have people on land doing the mass movements. The Global Smooth Flotilla is not supposed to be a mission. It's supposed to be an internationalist movement against oppression, against exploitation, and against the destruction of nature, that has Gaza as its fundamental and strategic goal, but will not stop there, because there's a system that enables genocide. Enables genocide in Palestine, but enables in Sudan and Congo, and enables the ecocide in the Amazon forest, and enables the ecocide of climate destruction. So that's why we need to continue mobilizing. There's a whole lot of things for the peoples of the world to finally be free and live in a fair society. So we are willing to do this task. It's very hard, it's very dangerous, but once we grow, once we organize better, we create the conditions to be successful. I believe we will be successful in this task. So that's why we need to continue going.
Tiago, you mentioned families, and that you have a family, and we all wouldn't want to see our families being destroyed. How does tell us a bit about your family, and how does your wife deal with you going on these missions where you are inevitably going to be thrown into Israeli jails, mistreated, and how does it impact your kids as well? I believe you do have kids. Tell us about that, and just how that kind of makes you feel, and how they respond to that, and what that has been like.
Well, people keep on asking me when I'm on a mission, say, what does your wife think about that? And I always say, Ashfaq, my wife is a coordinator of the mission as well. My wife is also an activist. We met doing this. When I'm training people in nonviolence direct action, in how to behave and how to do, for example, human entangling, if they're trying to push someone to commit a violation against someone, police violence, the videos that I show showing people how to do it. It's my wife on the video. So I said, look, this is my wife, the person on the video. So people understand that our family is based on that. We see, I'm a proud father of an almost 2-year-old daughter. And there's nothing more dangerous for her than living in a world where genocides can happen like that. And we always not only think about the dangers of that, but we also think that the fathers of the Palestinian people, of the every Palestinian children, of the 18,000 identified killed in the last 2 years, but there are many more that were not identified, and all the others that are still alive, almost 600,000 children in Gaza still alive, their fathers, they love their daughters as much as I love mine. And there's nothing more important to give as a legacy, not only to my daughter, but to all the children in the world, that a better society that will never allow something like this to happen ever again. So, of course, it's bad to stay away from home. I'm actually so happy that I'm home, and I'm already going to travel tomorrow to start planning for the next mission. But there's nothing more important than creating a society where children of the world will be safe, because humanity will be restored and will not be subject to this horrific system that destroys everything for profit, destroys everything in the project of domination. So our family has a very tough time because we received a lot of death threats. This time, during interrogations, they were threatening my baby daughter. So it's very tough. But we know that we need to continue doing that, because we need to build a future where this will not happen anymore.
Tiago Avila, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck with all that you are planning for. And it was really a great pleasure to catch up with you, and I'm sure we'll be speaking some more in the future.
Thank you so much, Asha. It was a pleasure to be with you here, and I would like to also thank Middle East Eye as well. And it's very nice to be here in Unapologetic as well, because to spread true information, to break the media lies, the mainstream media lies, is also something strategic, and you're part of that. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Tiago, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not so unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.